Posman, Mr. Newfer.
I think all the family units are leaving.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
May it please the court.
Court can just empty.
Big family, right?
We were here once before, and this court ruled in favor of our client, Sidney Weinschneider, that the trustee breached an unambiguous general release and covenant not to sue. We are now back, and the simple question is whether Sidney Weinschneider has a remedy and can recover the damages that he has suffered because of that breach.
Well, by damages, you mean the attorney's fees.
That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Weinschneider paid over $1 million for a general release and a covenant not to sue, and now has had to expend and incur at least $500,000 additional.
Well, that's the breaks. You know, that's what happens. If you have a contract and someone breaks it, you have to incur attorney's fees to defend it. And a covenant not to sue and a release, that's just a form of contract.
Your argument seems to assume that inherent in the idea of a covenant not to sue is the notion that the measure of damages would be the attorney's fees you spent if that covenant is breached. But unfortunately, Illinois law, and indeed the law of most states, doesn't buy that.
I think that under Illinois law, if there is a breach of contract that requires a party to incur expenses, the rule...
Every breach of contract requires a party to incur attorney's fees as expenses in pursuing
that's
relief.
That's right.
But we don't have a general English rule here in Illinois.
And we're not talking about the English rule. We're talking about a recognized exception in both federal and state courts that there is an exception to the American rule that...
Why should there be that exception? A covenant not to sue is a very valuable, not to be sued, is a very valuable thing to have because, I mean, suppose someone has a $10 million claim against you. So you get a covenant not to sue, and if he sues you, well, he's not going to be able to, you know, get $10 million. Yes, because you'll interpose the covenant as a defense. Yeah, you'll have to incur some legal expense. That doesn't mean... make releases or covenants not to sue worthless?
This situation and the law in this situation is very analogous to duty to defend cases.
No,
but it isn't, because a duty to defend is a contractual clause saying we promise to pay the costs of your defense, which is precisely the language that you don't have in your particular covenant not to sue.
The covenant not to sue... was
See,
to
the
buy
analogy
peace.
Would be if you were arguing, which would fail, that an insurance contract inherently includes a duty to defend at the insurer's expense. That's the analogy. Right? You'd argue that, well, if you buy insurance, surely what you want is not only indemnification, you also want the insurance company to pay the costs of your defense. And of course, that's not the law any more than shifting attorneys' fees for releases is.
Well, it's our position that duty to defend cases are very analogous to this situation.
No, they're not analogous at all, because as Judge Wood said, there you have an explicit duty imposed on the insurer to pay attorneys' fees, and you could have written this into the release or the covenant not to sue.
Well, if we buy into that argument, our position is that that renders the covenant not to sue superfluous.
No, I just showed it wasn't. Well, the significance of the covenant not to sue is that if someone tries to sue you, you interpose that as a defense, so you have no liability. That's like insurance. You know, you're insured against that, but you still have to pay your attorney's fees.
But if there's a breach of that contract, you incur damages.
You have to pay something for the benefit, but it really depends on what the claim was worth. In Judge Posner's example, if it's a $10 million claim and you have to spend $1 million in attorney's fees, as you claim your client did, you've gotten a $9 million benefit out of the covenant not to sue. because you interpose it, you defeat the lawsuit for the $10 million that now goes forward. Obviously, if it's only a $500,000 claim and you have to spend $1 million to get rid of it, maybe you haven't behaved in an economically rational way. But it comes back to the question of the background legal rule. Is there a background legal rule in the state of Illinois that says this is an exception to the ordinary American rule? And the cases that have been discussed, certainly the child case that's been around now for 40 years, says no, there is no exception.
But the lower courts ignored the other rule, though, in Illinois law that we cited that goes back into the 1850s and is discussed in the Ritter case. And, in fact, this court did recognize that rule in 1989. If I can find it in my notes real quick, that in the Champion Parts case that we cited, they said, in Illinois, where the wrongful acts of a defendant involve a plaintiff in litigation with third parties or place him in such relation with others as to make it necessary to incur expenses to protect his interest, the plaintiff can recover damages against the wrongdoer measured by the reasonable expenses of such litigation.
Who's the third party here? Mr. Weinschneider has his release, and now this is just litigation, the same people.
He had to incur expenses to protect his interest vis-a-vis the state court lawsuit.
But there's no third party.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Just quoting the language from the Illinois case law.
I don't think that third party is in the sense of a third party in a particular litigation. He has an interest vis-a-vis the state court lawsuit.
I don't understand you. What is the significance of the reference in the Ritter case to the third party?
I'm not sure that. I think that the significance is that that's the most common way that it would come about, is that there would be.
But now you're reading Ritter to mean that the American rule doesn't prevail in Illinois, because any time someone breaches a contract, he imposes costs on the other side.
No, and I think that in Ritter the Supreme Court made it clear that in most cases the American rule applies, but a plaintiff can't sue twice, and in Ritter that's what happened. The plaintiff, sued to protect her interest, and then she brought a second suit to recover the fees from the first one, and the Supreme Court said, no, we're not going to allow that under the American rule, but it cited those other earlier cases.
What was the third party in Ritter? Who was the third party?
Third party in Ritter?
The way you just described the case was successive suits against the same party.
Right.
But apparently the court thought there was the third part, like the third man.
No, they were just discussing the rule, Judge, in Ritter.
A rule that wasn't applicable?
Right.
Look, I thought this was an insurance release in Ritter. Isn't this is the, if I'm remembering
No, it was the child case. It was the insurance release.
Okay.
Okay, but Ritter does cite the rule that I've been referring to. And that rule, in turn, many cases subsequent to that have cited it in Illinois. And so it's our position, as demonstrated in the briefs, that in Illinois there is a rule that allows recovery of damages, even though they happen to take the form of attorney fees.
So it's not limited to releases?
I don't believe so. It's a broad rule.
So anytime you sue twice, so that the second time the defendant would interpose a defense of res judicata, the plaintiff would have to pay defendant's attorney's fees? And that second
No. I think that the way that it cuts in Ritter is that they're essentially saying that if I'm sued.
That's just the example. I sue you.
You sue me.
You win. I sue you again. You plead res judicata as a defense. You win the second case. Mm-hmm. Now, do I have to pay you your attorney's fees in that second case?
I don't believe so.
Then I'm completely lost, because you said Ritter stands for the rule you can't sue a person twice. Sue him a second time, you have to pay his fees.
Well, I think, if I may, Your Honor, address the issue that the district court addressed, which is that somehow our claim does depend on state law. It's our position that we have a federal law claim here.
That's another loser, in my opinion, to be very blunt about it, because what you want to do is to inject into bankruptcy a federal rule shifting fees in release cases. And that's just the sort of thing the Supreme Court says, you know, you're not supposed to do that unless there's some special bankruptcy interest. You enforce the entitlements that people have outside of bankruptcy. So if Illinois law doesn't allow you to collect attorney's fees for breach of a covenant not to sue, then you can't get that just because you're in bankruptcy.
We believe that in these kinds of situations that the injury that Mr. Weinschneider suffered does qualify as an administrative expense under Section 503.
Why? That is, what special bankruptcy interest is there in shifting fees in this situation? How does it impede bankruptcy if fees aren't shifted?
Because it holds bankruptcy trustees accountable for their breaches of contract. What we're essentially saying is that a trustee can enter into
a contract. Even worse. Now you're saying that there's some general rule that if a trustee sues anyone and loses, then he has to pay the winner's attorney's fees.
What I'm saying is that if he enters into a contract that promises not to sue, and he breaches
why
it.
Why is that special? Why is that
but
special?
But what if he's challenging the validity of that contract, which he was, of course, ultimately unsuccessfully, but he said that there were fundamental problems with this release because there was failure to disclose, there was fraud, there was this, there was that. Mm-hmm. And no one has thought that that was a frivolous claim. It was simply an unsuccessful claim. And the district court and the bankruptcy court here both thought that the fact that this was a good faith claim, that it was some claim that the trustee got permission even from the bankruptcy court to go forward with and so on, meant that it was not a fee-shifting kind of situation that bankruptcy law at least calls for.
Well, it's our position. He can certainly challenge it, but he better be right. If he's wrong and he's barred by his contract, a contract that he promised not to litigate.
Even though there's nothing in the bankruptcy. This doesn't enrich the bankruptcy estate. This isn't, I mean, usually administrative expenses are for things that benefit the estate. This clearly does not.
Well, that was the whole point of reading. If there's an injury that affects
right,
others.
That's when the trustee wasted an asset of the estate, and that's not this case. The trustee was trying, with the permission of the court, to collect what, in good faith, he thought was an asset.
Well, there was no ruling regarding good faith, but the situation was that there was a settlement and a general release and a covenant not to sue. Our client paid $1 million, and then there was a breach. And under the general damages rule, he's entitled to recover his damages. And we think we have a good federal claim.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Newfer. Mr. Radke, or?
May it please the court. I'd just like to make one point about the record in this case. On the fraudulent inducement issue, whether the trustee was fraudulently induced to sign this release and covenant not to sue. The trustee was correct in the first instance. He went to trial in the bankruptcy court, and the bankruptcy court conducted an evidentiary hearing. At the conclusion of that hearing, the court ruled that the trustee had been fraudulently induced to sign that release and covenant
not to sue. Why is that legally relevant to us at this stage of the game, given what this court found in terms of the release and the covenant not to sue later? I mean, that what you say, I mean, it certainly appears in the record. I understand that. But why is it pertinent? Why don't we just look at the case as some litigation that happened? It was litigation that happened, no one thought, for frivolous or unreasonable reasons, but it was unsuccessful for a legal reason. Well, now we're dealing with fees.
I think it has to be considered in terms of context, Your Honor. Trustee didn't even know about this state court action. It was Mr. Newfer's partner who approached the trustee at the close of the case and disclosed this state court action to the trustee, and he had no knowledge of any of the facts or even of the filing in that case. They then asked the trustee, to perform what in effect is a judicial function. They ask the trustee to sign off on an affidavit saying that this state court action is not property of the estate. The trustee's not willing to do that. He's not able to do that. It begs for declaratory relief. And
but
that's
your
what
opponent
the
argues,
did.
I mean, that's all background, but, I mean, your opponent says, nonetheless, you know, covenants not to sue either under this Redding theory or under the these ancient Illinois cases fall within some sort of exception to the normal rule that each side bears its own fees.
I don't believe that's correct, Your Honor, under the case law, and Mrs. Miller is going to address that more than me, but...
Okay.
Why is there both a release and a covenant not to sue? The release is broader and it covers everything, doesn't it, in the covenant not to sue?
It is. The court must remember that these documents arose out of a fraudulent conveyance action. Before he filed his bankruptcy, Mr. Weinschneider had transferred substantial assets into three trusts for his benefit and the benefit of his wife and several children. And what Mr. Weinschneider was concerned about was the trustee pursuing his children. That's why those documents were prepared.
You're not answering my question. Why are there two documents, one of which completely covers the other? Why doesn't a release, what does a covenant not to sue add to a release?
I don't know that it adds anything, Your Honor.
Why do people do it?
It was something that was requested at the time.
Why?
That I don't recall, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Ms. Miller?
May it please the Court. I'll begin by addressing the question of whether a release and a covenant not to sue have any different effect. There are Illinois cases which say that a release extinguishes a claim.
Could you speak louder? I can't hear you.
Certainly. There are Illinois cases which say that a release extinguishes a claim and a covenant not to sue is a defense to a suit. Those are obviously overlapping functions, but it might be the case, and we think it was the case here, that the attorneys felt that to make assurance double sure, they would ask for both of those provisions. It's absolutely clear under Illinois law that neither of those provisions can be interpreted as a promise to pay attorney's fees. And so even if you believe there is some redundancy between them, that doesn't mean that
there... But you can see that it gives Mr. Newfer a little tiny opening to argue that, well, you know, we're supposed to try to interpret documents, contracts, what have you, statutes, so that they all have some meaning, some significance. So when you have this complete redundancy, it's natural to ask, well, why? Why'd they throw in the covenant not to sue when the release covered all the same ground plus more?
Two responses, Your Honor. I don't believe it is a complete redundancy. I think it's a considerable redundancy, but not a considerable
one. Well, what would
be
a case where the release was not a defense, but a covenant not to sue was?
Well, there are, for example, cases which generally happen to be tort cases where a release affects joint tort feasors and a covenant not to sue does not.
Right.
So as a matter of drafting a contract...
So the release is broader in that case.
That's right, although I'm not sure a party could defend on the ground the affirmative defense of you promise not to sue me as opposed to the affirmative defense of this claim has been released. Again, even if it is an opening, I don't think that that's a basis to read that opening as a provision for attorney's fees in this contract because Illinois law is so clear on that point. Mm-hmm. If I could, I'd just like to say that as the court's questions suggest, the Redding case is a case about priority, and they have to establish that they have a claim for attorney's fees before we get to the question of priority. We think Illinois law is clear that there is no claim for attorney's fees and damages in this case, and we think their federal law theory also lacks merits for the reasons in our brief.
Mm-hmm.
We'd be happy to rest on our brief.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Your time has expired, Mr. Newfer, so we thank both sides. All three sides.